This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A giant of the civil rights movement died 3 months ago, Rosa Parks, whose refusal to move to the back of a bus spurred the historic Montgomery bus boycott of 1955. Among its organizers was a young minister who would soon become known across the country and around the world as a champion of civil rights and of the power of nonviolent protest. Today, the nation commemorates the life and the death of Martin Luther King Jr., who would have turned 77 yesterday. In the almost 40 years since his assassination, marches and boycotts and teach-ins helped to bring an end to legal discrimination. Now a new set of issues confronts a new generation. Many young civil rights leaders today weren't born when Martin Luther King died and never experienced the kind of segregation he fought. And Black America is very different, too, more diverse than ever in terms of income, education, political affiliation, geography, and culture. Later in the program, we'll take a look at some of the questions raised by this weekend's airstrike in Pakistan. But first, new challenges for a new generation of civil rights leaders. Is the movement over or headed in a new direction? What are you fighting for and how? Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our first guest today is Cory Booker, a mayoral candidate in Newark, New Jersey. He joins us by phone from his office there. And thanks very much for sharing part of your holiday with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Neil. Thank you for having me.
As you campaign for mayor of Newark, New Jersey, do you mention the civil rights movement? Do you consider yourself part of it?
Yeah, well, I think it's a consistent theme in all I do in this city. It's a majority black city, and the spirit of King is very much alive in the sense that we here in Newark feel like we're a part of a larger struggle that's been continuing for decades, reaching back even before the civil rights movement. So I definitely do try to invoke a lot of the themes and a lot of the ideas, and many of the precious things that King fought for, we're still fighting for here in the city of Newark.
Give us some for instances, if you would.
Well, you know, unfortunately, our city still struggles. We are the second poorest city, judged by median income, in the United States for cities over a quarter of a million. We still have horrible graduation rates in our public schools that we're fighting to change. We're still facing a city that has, for black men, serious unemployment rate, nearly 50%. So a lot of the things when it comes to basic economic justice, when it comes to being able to have affordable safeties and housing and quality education or even access to health care, many in this community are still struggling with what I believe should be a fundamental part of being an American.
Newark, like every other city, I guess, still has an entrenched political establishment. But in Newark's case, that's an entrenched black political establishment.
It has been. In many ways, in fact, Newark made headlines in the national press in 1970 for having one of the first black mayors in America, who was Ken Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a city in which political power was claimed. But many of us, I think, and I've heard my parents' generation talk often, that they thought simply getting political power would therefore mean that many of the other issues would soon follow. But unfortunately, they did not. And we made many strides. And so I was born in 1969, and I'm really proud of what my parents' generation did. But living in Newark, and I live in public housing high-rise, I see a lot of the challenges that people are still struggling with and know that we have to now carry that torch that they lit so brightly even further forward.
But even in terms of new challenges for a new generation, clearly fighting a black political establishment is not something that Martin Luther King would have had much experience with.
Well, no, he wouldn't. But at the same time, he was not somebody that was fighting for black justice. He was fighting for principles of justice that are deeper than race or religion. And he said that time and time again. And so whatever the principalities or powers you're fighting against, justice is still the same. And I know that as someone who's inherited that legacy, it was never about fighting against white people. It was about fighting for these principles. And that's something that I think that people in my team and my organization are really committed to.
When you were growing up, as you mentioned, it was your parents' generation who were of the civil rights movement, and I know that this was infused throughout your childhood. I wonder, why did you decide on politics as the means of expression? Obviously, Martin Luther King Jr. went into the ministry. Other people have chosen a lot of other areas to do.
Right, and you know, it was something that was difficult for me, and I never pictured myself into politics, and most of my professional career was grassroots organizing. I've been a grassroots lawyer since I graduated from law school. But, you know, I come from a great family, as you said, that was involved in the civil rights movement. My father was involved in the sit-in movement when he was in college. My mother was involved in organizing a lot of marches, including the March on Washington. But my parents in 1969, fought a court case to actually be the first black family to move into a white neighborhood in northern New Jersey. And as I grew up there, my parents were very heavy with my brother and I, and very serious that we were enjoying incredible fruits of this nation, incredible opportunity. But with that opportunity came an incredible responsibility. And my parents very powerfully said to me, me and my brother, that this nation, they were very big patriots. They said this nation was born in perfect ideals, but a savagely imperfect reality, and that the history of this country is a history of ordinary people doing extraordinary things, things not expected of them, to make real on this promise of this great democracy. So my parents said that you and your brother have to be involved in this struggle. And I moved to Newark just to be a sort of a, my dream was to be a nonprofit leader and a grassroots leader. But as I started to uncover the shortcomings of the local government, as I began to uncover what I believed were even corruption, I thought that the best way to try to help move my city forward was to get involved in politics and changing the political process, which I thought could unleash the potential and the power and the strength of our neighborhoods.
We want to get some listeners involved in the conversation quickly, so 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us, or send us an email, totn@npr.org. But before we go to the first call, Cory Booker, I wonder, do you think that the next generation, your children, will be as engaged as your generation is?
I really think they will be. And, you know, I'm now 36, and I work with kids every week in various programs, and I see that the stories have even become more storied, more legendary. And I think that people do feel an obligation. And if you live in neighborhoods like mine, or even neighborhoods in the suburbs, I really see an activism amongst this next generation that's very inspiring to me. So I'm very hopeful. I know a lot of people poo-poo the younger generation and my generation, the X generation or the hip-hop generation, in many ways with getting a bad rap. But I'm just seeing people finding new ways of getting involved. It may not necessarily be copying or mirroring our parents, but we have found new ways of activism using entertainment, using technology, leveraging the best of our generation to deal with longstanding and unfortunately too persistent problems.
800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. What are the new challenges for civil rights, and who are the new leaders? And let's get a call in from John. John's calling from Roseville, California.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I may be way off the mark here, but I believe there's going to come a time to where we have to move beyond the minority-majority classifications. And I think as if we can look at each other as equals and not look at a person with a darker complexion as a black man and separate from us, that we can all be together one majority and put behind us this minority classification, which seems to carry with it a demeaning sense of well-being. This may be a very complex thought for people to grasp a hold of, but I think that together we can all be one majority and work together for what is best for all. And I think Dr. Martin Luther King would have taken a hold of this and wanted us to all work together instead of in separate, you know, the NAACP, the Mexican Hispanic groups, all these groups are working for their own little groups. Why don't we join a group together?
Cory Booker?
Well, John, I'm really sympathetic to the spirit behind your question, and I think the spirit of what you are saying is a spirit that resonates with King's words, where he said, you know, we are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a common garment of destiny. But you have to realize that there are real racial realities in our nation, and you can't get to that kind of utopia, which I think we all seek, by ignoring racial realities, and you have to confront them. You know, I live in New Jersey, which as many people think is a very progressive state, but we lead the nation in racial disparities and incarceration. Blacks are 12% of the population, but we make up over 61% of the prison population. Now, that's a racial reality and means that the prison systems or the criminal justice system is having a disproportionate impact on African Americans because, again, the majority of blacks are in there for nonviolent drug offenses, and blacks in no way have a statistically higher rate of using drugs or abusing drugs than whites do. So So I hear what you're saying, but I believe in that wholeheartedly.
Mr. Booker, I think that we can address this by educating and reaching to our youth and starting them with a different philosophy in schools and you know, start there, and then we wouldn't have this disparity of, you know, of the blacks or the minorities in jails, and we would create a society where nobody is looked upon as different.
But John, only if you're willing to confront again racial realities or the realities of bigotry,
those realities.
John, let me give you an example. You know, to this day, most Americans might recognize the name of JoBenet Ramsey, the young white girl that was killed tragically, an unsolved mystery. But I live in a city where black children, unfortunately, are killed all the time, but they never break into the mainstream media because it doesn't seem like the value of the young black child here is killed when they're killed is as great as the value of the young white attractive girl that was killed. So I believe exactly what you say, and I really do feel, again, the spirit of what you're saying. We all really are all in this together, and as you just said, we have to confront this with education, but we can't confront it by ignoring race as an issue in this country because it still is so alive and well. I did my graduate work in sociology, and we actually did studies where you would use the same resumes as people but put different races of pictures on them, and you would see how people would treat white candidates differently than black candidates. We did studies with people buying cars and automobiles or negotiating for insurance and the like, and you still see how race is a reality. So I do believe we need to unify each other because the truth of the matter is that is strength. Sticks in a bundle can't be broken. The great Golda Meir said a wonderful thing where she said, Jews together are strong, but Jews with other people are invincible. And that invincibility is what King was looking for, but he did not look for it by ignoring race as an issue. He looked for it by trying to confront people with the brutality of a Bull Connor or the ugliness of their racial acts.
Cory Booker, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there, but thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate
your
time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Cory Booker is running for mayor in Newark, New Jersey. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about more new civil rights leaders, who they are and what they represent. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The first Martin Luther King Jr. holiday was celebrated 20 years ago. He would have turned 77 this year. Today we're talking about new civil rights leaders, particularly those born after Martin Luther King's assassination. What are the new challenges of the civil rights movement for today? Do you think the movement is over? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Earlier, we spoke with a mayoral candidate in New Jersey. Politics is not the only route that civil rights leaders follow today. Rhea Mokind is director of Listen Up, a youth media network for young filmmakers, and she joins us now from our bureau in New York City. And it's nice to have you today on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Do you consider yourself active in civil rights?
Well, I hadn't thought of it quite that way. I've always considered myself an activist, certainly, but I had not put civil rights before that moniker.
Why not?
Well, I think that when I think of civil rights, I certainly think that it embodies the work that I do, but I prefer to think of it as human rights. I think at the end of his life, Dr. King really recognized the humanity that's certainly explicit in the call for civil rights and talked about certainly more global concerns. And that's the way I think I've approached my work.
And you work primarily through the medium of film. And all right, why movies?
Well, the two came together for me coincidentally. While I was a student at CUNY undergrad, I did a lot of
City University of New York, but go ahead.
The City University of New York. I did a lot of sort of grassroots mobilization work, certainly around incarceration of black males. And I also worked to support myself at a production company. So the two sort of came together very accidentally, but it's a happy mix because what I've found is that young people certainly are very media savvy.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. and want to have access to the tools of production. And it's a great way to be able to tell your story and to gather and create audience.
Gather and create audience. Obviously, a message matters a lot when you're gathering and creating audience.
Absolutely. What I found in the last 8 years is that young people are inherently activist. Young people want to bring those who aren't in their community into the community. And what better way than through pictures? What better way than through media?
And I wonder, in your work with young people, do you find that they think of what they do in the context of the civil rights movement anymore?
They certainly don't. I think young people, certainly the ones that I have worked with in the last 8 years, have really thought in terms of grassroots activism, have really thought in terms of civic engagement, but we haven't explicitly talked about civil rights as a component of this work.
Mm-hmm.
They've thought about creating messages, engaging community, creating change, but I don't think anyone has presented them with the label civil rights that they've been working with,
and nor a single agenda, the civil rights agenda that existed 40 and 50 years ago.
Absolutely. You know, I think for a lot of young people, they think that that may not apply wholesale anymore. A lot of young people don't know, unfortunately, don't fully understand the historic role that young people of that generation played in the civil rights movement. Young people today think that the civil rights movement has passed, that that was about voter registration, that that was about, the Ku Klux Klan, not understanding the holistic reality of what Dr. King and all of his comrades were working toward. And today, you know, when you talk about civil rights with young people, they think more in terms of their ability to engage in the world on an equal footing with everyone else. And although to me that translates as civil rights, it may not to them.
Let's get some more listeners in the conversation. This is Shirley. Shirley's calling us from Jackson, Michigan.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is that I'm finding I'm a teacher, high school teacher, mm-hmm. and I have started a group that teaches Black history. We go all over the place. We've been to the White House, all over the country. And one of the problems that, or one of the things that I see we are dealing with is subtle racism. We try to target, and I have young people, these are high schoolers, 30, 35 high school students. And we go into schools that don't have diversity or very little. We've gone into schools that maybe have one or two Black kids. And I'm finding, and this program has been overwhelmingly successful, but I'm finding that people that, first, there are two classes. There are people who really don't know anything about the Black struggle, the Black movement, Black civil rights. And then there are those who maybe know a little bit, but they do, they practice what I call, or what we call, subtle racism. I see this in the schools in Michigan, and I'll give you an example. Maybe a Black child wants to take an advanced class, and he is told the class is full, and he can't get in. And then he turns around, and in the same class, a white student comes and says, "Now I want to get in that class." He is let in. Little things like that, making it hard for Black teachers to get on in the system. Oh, we don't have any openings. We'll call you if we do have one, and then in the back door, so to speak, bringing in white teachers. So I'm seeing with my children and the group that we have in teaching, we teach about Black history. We do skits and singing and poetry. And the kids, wherever we go, they just love our kids, and they just grasp what we're trying to teach them. And I'm finding that the young people today are very into why it's important that people understand about the different cultures. Our motto is racism is out and diversity is in. And when we go in, we're teaching people. We teach little children. It doesn't matter what color you are. You know, we're all special. We're all equal. And that's a message that we drive home. And we've been doing this now for 11 years. And it is very, very successful. It has broken down. This group has broken down walls of racism all over the place with grown-ups, with little kids, high schoolers, college people. So I feel that if Dr. King were living today, he would favor very highly what this group is doing, because we don't go in and say we're black, you're white, not that type of thing. You know, we're going, we make everybody feel special. We make, you know, the children feel like, you know, we're all like sisters and brothers. We're all special. And I find that young people don't have the issues that the older people have. They don't have issues about that. Young people are just eating it up, you know.
Let's see if we get a response from Rhea Mokin. And you know, part of what Shirley's talking about is that, you know, I guess there's a big distinction between, you could draw a picture of Bull Connor and the Ku Klux Klan on the one hand, and more subtle forms of racism today.
Absolutely. I think that with the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, in the 30 years since then, you can certainly make the argument that institutional racism has been exposed. But in fact, those subtler forms of racism thrive. And it depends on, and it really thrives on the fact that you hope that the person who is the victim of that kind of racism is not aware or is not in tune with the opportunities that would enable them to speak out about it. And again, that's why for young people, media becomes so absolutely powerful. When a young person is able to say, this is my life, this is what's happening in my life, I'm treated this way, and I suspect the reason is because I am different somehow, because I'm a young person of color, because I'm an immigrant youth, because I'm a queer youth, and they're able to share that message with hundreds, if not thousands of people, and all of a sudden, a huge percentage of the audience can identify with that, then it moves from the personal to the political. It's become a larger social, a larger community issue. And these young people being able to go out in the schools in Michigan and make change by engaging the audience, that's simply what media is able to do, except that it does not depend on the individual person being in front of each audience. The film can actually take that message out to the audience itself.
Shirley, thanks very much for the phone call, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And I wanted to ask you, Rhea Mokin, in terms of young people getting control of the images, there's a fairly sizable group of young African Americans who do get to control a lot of imagery that they put on in terms of music videos and that sort of thing. And many people would regard a lot of the imagery that they put on as not being very positive, as thugs and women disrespected.
Absolutely. Although I would urge us to look really closely, though, at who's controlling those messages, because there is, and you're talking about hip hop videos, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's an even larger segment of the hip hop population that talks about politics, that talks about activism. And those videos don't get $1 million budgets. Who's approving these budgets? Who is directing these music videos? A lot of times they're not African Americans. You know, who are in control of the airwaves? They're not African Americans. They're not people who are interested in the positivity, if you will, of the hip hop community. They're interested in a very stereotypical image for the purposes of money. So it's not altogether fair to say that, you know, there are huge amounts of, or there are large amounts of young black people who are in control of the media they make. These are the ones that are propped up. These are the ones that are given the resources. And these are the ones that are told, this is the message that you have to, this is the message that we want to listen to. This is the message that you have to tell. You know, we have other artists, we have other musicians who do amazing work, who don't get the same kind of label support, who don't get the same kind of record support.
I hear what you're saying. Well, you do have to ask why, but one of the reasons why is that their message doesn't sell so well.
Says who?
Says the sales figures that return. You know, the people will try anything that in hopes of getting a commercial sale. Some things do sell better than others.
Yes, and so you do have to ask, though, if sex sells, then why do you have to put so much money into it? If I'm the head of a record label, why do I need to then invest $20 million in an artist when I think the message is enough to sell? It's bad enough that the message is what it is, but then you have to admit that the marketing budgets for those are much more expanded than they are for an artist who's trying to represent something that's perhaps a little bit different. And I think that's at least part of the question that we have to ask.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
Absolutely.
Rhea Mokin is director of Listen Up, and she was kind enough to join us today at our bureau in New York. Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Lawrence Patrick, president and CEO of the Black Alliance for Educational Options here in Washington, D.C. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Very kind of you to share part of your holiday with us.
Thanks for having me.
And am I wrong to think that the emphasis you would like to put on is in education?
I think that's a good guess.
So we've had some person go into politics, another young person go into film as an engine for change. Why are you going into education?
Well, we think that education is a really pivotal in terms of bringing about the social change necessary to elevate black people in America, partially because education touches so many different facets of the society, but also because we believe that education plays just a very critical role in terms of young people and shaping the next generation, positioning the next generation to be able to continue to promulgate the change.
Is in that, from your perspective, is the civil rights movement continuing? Is it changing? Is it evolving? Is it over?
I think Rhea got it about right. I don't think young people today view the work that they have to do as a continuation or version 2.0 or 3.0 of the civil rights movement. I think the civil rights movement was significant and powerful and can stand alone as a very important part of our shared legacy as Americans. But I think that other social movements are just as significant and powerful and can stand alone. And I think that the work we're doing around education, you know, fighting for parental choice, really stands alone as its own social movement in America.
Mm-hmm. We're talking on this Martin Luther King Day about new issues for civil rights and the future of the civil rights movement. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, TOTN@NPR.org. And and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is John. John's calling us from Cincinnati. Hello, John.
Hello.
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay. I'm 72 years old, sir, and I want to thank you for taking my call. I have children who were born in 1970, 72, 75, and 76. So to expect them to think the way that I did 40 years ago, or children in that born in after the 60s is totally wrong. They expect to compete in the world because they've been competing with white kids and all other kids ever since they started school. They don't have the feeling that we had. It's a whole total ball game for these children. And I think the other thing is we have to realize the effect of the internet and the computers, the email. My kids email people all over the world. So they have a total conception of different. The civil rights movement is over. It's not human rights. But we have a generation of young people, white, black, red, and yellow, who have grown up differently. They have a whole different concept of what we old people had, and we should not be saying they don't understand what happened. They do understand.
It's just that maybe they've gone past us old geezers just a little bit, John. Let's get a response from Lawrence Patrick.
Well, I would agree with the sentiment. I think it's important to raise the issue of technology and global competition. You know, one of the reasons why education is so important is because it does control whether or not, you know, as a country, we're going to be able to be competitive in the future. And I think that's the lens a lot of people view the issue through.
Let me ask you also, but at John's point, though, one thing that is clearly different is that this generation, your generation, if you will, is a product of the integrated era of education, of public education, as opposed to Dr. King's generation, which certainly was not.
Well, I mean, that's sort of true. I mean, I'm from Detroit, and so the public schools that I went to my whole life were 98% black. And I lived in a city that was 98% black. So when you say I'm a product of the integrated generation, I mean, that's sort of true. I mean, I think a better way to say it is that, you know, our generation was the generation that grew up during a time when the government did not, you know, enforce through a system of law segregation. So, I mean, that's sort of another way to say it. But, you know, I don't know how much integration was actually happening for my generation.
Hmm. John, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Good luck to you. Lawrence Patrick, I wanted to wrap up with you by asking also about this idea of choice that you were talking about, that parents need choices and presumably communities need choices as well. 30, 40 years ago, people would have been much more comfortable talking about the community, the movement, than they would be today because, it's not just one community.
That's true. I mean, I think one of the things that that people have learned is that black people are not monolithic, that there are, you know, a lot of different ideas and a lot of different sentiments within the community. But I think the reality is that on our particular issue, and our issue is parental choice. In other words, the idea that every parent, especially low-income and struggling working-class parents, should have the ability to decide where their children go to school, that they should have the power to choose their school. and also that they should have lots of excellent options from which to choose. That idea has major traction if you look at the opinion polling across the Black community. So we see overwhelming support in the Black community for the idea of parental choice. An interesting thing is as you actually peel back the layers and look at the generations, the support goes way up when you get to the 18 to 35 range. And it's a very, I think, powerful example of some of the differences in terms of how generations view the issue.
Lawrence Patrick, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in today as well. Lawrence Patrick is president and CEO of the Black Alliance for Educational Options. He's located here in Washington, D.C. He was with us in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, we'll look at more options for the future of civil rights and talk about some of the questions raised by this past weekend's airstrike in Pakistan. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking about the new generation of civil rights leaders, who they are, and how the movement has changed in the nearly 40 years since the death of Martin Luther King. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, totn@npr.org. Yvonne Bino is the author of Stand and Deliver, Political Activism, Leadership, and Hip-Hop Culture. She joins us here in Studio 3A. Very good to have you on the program.
Thank you for inviting me on.
And the title of your book is almost a definition of why we would want you on the show today to talk about the leadership of the civil rights movement, such as it is, and where it's going.
I'd be happy to do so. I guess for me, where I want to start is we certainly listened to the other callers as well as your other guests who talked about kind of the obsolescence in some respects of civil rights. And I tend to not agree with that. I think that the conversation needs to be, frankly, redefined. I think it's become so amorphous. And when we talk about civil rights, I think so many groups have co-opted that term that I think individual groups and individual activists are going to have to be better about defining for themselves and their own agendas what does civil rights mean. For me, it's the advocacy of laws and public policies that facilitate the ability of each of our citizens to really, regardless of race or income level, to access the educational opportunities, the economic opportunities, and the social institutions that make up this nation. We can talk about laws and we can talk about government intervention, but if there's no substantive or practical way that people can actually become involved, it's kind of illusory.
You talk about hip-hop culture in the title of your book, and obviously that is a dominant culture in many parts of the Black community today. Is it one that lends itself to activism?
Well, let me just back up. It's American culture. Hip-hop is the most popular of all of the popular culture right now, and certainly it does resonate among Black Americans. I think that one of the conversations that continues to be had among younger African Americans particularly is whether or not hip-hop can be used as a political tool. And I think certainly we can look in the past and culture has been used to forward political agendas. I think, however, the hip-hop generation is the first to have, I guess, the artists at the forefront of a political and social movement as opposed to people who are following the agenda of the political leadership and activists. And frankly, I think it's a challenging model, and I don't think it's one that's particularly useful in looking at a 21st century global economy in particular.
Why not?
Because I think that artists are artists. I think that certainly we have people who have political ideas that are smart, who are engaged. But ultimately, if you are tied to an institution, I think one of your other guests said it earlier, you are being paid by the status quo institution. So to expect some radical change on the part of that artist, I think is somewhat nonsensical. More importantly, when do you focus on activism? In the middle of recording a record or in the middle of a tour, you're doing on your off time. And my proposition is that we need full-time activists and full-time political leaders, not people who are doing it in their spare time.
Would you suggest any models?
Well, I think we can look at some people like the late Sonny Bono. We can look at Jesse Ventura. These are people who had other lives and decided, hey, I want to get into the political game. And they quit those jobs and got into it full time. So certainly I could support an artist who was a rap artist who decided I want to become more engaged. And I'm going to stop recording or I'm going to stop, you know, filming or whatever and get involved on a full time basis.
Let's get another caller on the line. Kevin. Kevin's calling us from Kentucky.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I wanted to comment on the younger generation and civil rights issue. I don't feel that they are as connected to the civil rights issues as the younger generation was during the civil rights movement. I feel that the drive that those youth had during that time is lacking among the young generation now. I worked at a youth detention center, and I asked the question of some of the youth about some of the civil rights figures, you know, who Rosa Parks was, and I was surprised that a lot of them didn't know who Rosa Parks was. I think that, you know, a lot of them knew who Dr. King was because he is the most famous figure of the civil rights time. So, you know, he's talked about all the time. But some of the unsung heroes like Rosa Parks and, well, she's talked about, but Medgar Evers, for example, many of them had no idea who these figures were. And I think that they are just so disconnected. We're so far removed from the civil rights period that drive and that determination to succeed is lacking among the young generation. And also wanted to comment about the caller earlier in the other segment about us all being one majority. That's a noble idea, but I think it's an idealistic idea as well, because the fact is that racism, even though it's subtle now, it will always exist. And until we can get rid of that, which we never will be, I don't believe, there's going to be the need for these groups to try to better the opportunities for minority population.
Kevin, just to make sure that I understand your point, you're saying some of the kids you work with, the civil rights movement might be as they might feel as connected to that as they did to the abolitionist movement.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is that I think we're so far removed from it that a lot of these young people don't really know much about the civil rights movement. They don't really know much about the figures of that time, and that they don't have, I don't believe, that determination and that drive to succeed and to better themselves as the youth of that time did. I just feel like they're so disconnected that they just don't really have that push. You know, I asked about some of the figures and they had no idea who they were.
Let's ask Yvonne Bino about that.
I think that unfortunately the caller is right in some respects. I think that if you go to many of the schools, you have, you know, discussions about Martin Luther King, of course, maybe Malcolm X, depending on where in the country you are, and perhaps Harriet Tubman, and that's about the extent of the whole dialogue. I think Americans in general are unfortunately ahistorical. So when you start going into rural and urban communities, especially in low income areas, the information is even less funneled down. I think also, too, we keep moving away from some real facts. Looking at the civil rights movement, those were middle class people. These were people who did have access. These were a lot of times college students. So to use that model to say a disadvantaged student of today versus a somewhat advantaged college student of the 1960s, I don't know if that's quite a good way of analogizing the situation. I think that also, too, this generation did come up in an age where it was at least on paper legally integrated. We have access, many of us, to integrated situations. We are part of or can be part of the mainstream. But for a lot of the country, that is not their reality. It has not been their reality, and they don't foresee that as being part of their reality. So I think when we talk, we really have to be clear about who are we talking about, which blacks are we talking about. Are we talking about more affluent blacks? Are we talking about college-educated blacks? Are we talking about low-income? We can't keep using these lump everyone into one group, because the experiences are very different, and how they experience being Americans, unfortunately, is going to be different under those circumstances.
Hmm. Kevin, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Good luck. Yvonne, I wanted to ask you also, do you see your work explicitly in the terms of the civil rights movement?
I think I'm building on. That would be how I would frame it. I believe the civil rights movement in the form that we're discussing with Dr. King and the whole push for desegregation, legalized desegregation, certainly was relevant. It was important. It got me to where I am today. But I think we have to move on and look at some other issues that are dealing with the 21st century. You talked about Bayo. I think that's an interesting group. We do have to talk about education in a real and substantive way. No Child Left Behind is not doing the work that it needs to be done. But we have, in some areas, more than 50% of blacks and Latinos dropping out of school. What will be the prospects for these people in a couple of years? Even where children are going to school, they are still lacking academically behind their white and Asian peers. However, we do know how to make good schools, but it doesn't seem to be the political will to actually get on the stick and actually make education equitable for all groups. So I think that we are going to have some hard conversations conversations, economic access. In some places, there are no jobs. Or if there are jobs, they're out, they're out in the suburbs, and you have to have transportation to get to them. So I think that there are a lot of issues on the table that we must talk about more than these rhetoric and more than these drive-by conversations that are premised on symbolism, as opposed to really looking at public policy changes that are really going to be needed so people have practical access to these opportunities that do exist.
Yvonne Bino, thanks for joining us today, and good luck to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Yvonne Bino, her book is Stand and Deliver, Political Activism, Leadership, and Hip-Hop Culture, and she joined us here in Studio 3A.